The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
On the podcast this week, I have Taylor Jenkins Reid to talk about her novel, Daisy Jones and the Six. This novel is all about Daisy and her backup band, the Six. It's set in 1970s Los Angeles, and it reads like a he says, she says kind of memoir of sorts. We're all trying to work out who's lying, what really happened to this band. It's such a great book, and I was lucky enough to go to Taylor's house in Los Angeles, and we had lots of kind of collisions of where our lives had intersected. And her dog makes a brief appearance on the show too. You might be able to hear his heavy breathing in the mic. It was such a pleasure. Also, I have to say, the show has been picked up by Amazon, and Reese Witherspoon is producing the series. So read the book before that comes out, and I hope you enjoy the podcast. It's my great pleasure to welcome Taylor Jenkins Reid to the pod. Thank you for, well, I was about to say thank you for being here, but actually...
Thank you for being here.
So we should explain, we are in Los Angeles, and I was that sneaky person who invited herself to your home.
But I was very happy to have you. Very, very excited.
So we're here in Sherman Oaks,
yes.
LA.
Glamorous Sherman Oaks, which is the San Fernando Valley. So it's not the cool part of LA, but that's all right.
I think it's all cool.
Yeah. Okay. I'll take it. It's like the family friendly part of LA. It's like the suburban part.
But I have to say, as I got an Uber here, and I used to live in LA. I lived here for 4 years.
Oh, you did? Okay.
And I used to have a therapist mm-hmm. about 5 minutes away.
Oh, my therapist is 5 minutes away. Maybe we have the same therapist.
We could unpack that later.
Yeah.
But at the same, and then I had a voice coach because the embarrassing past is, you know, trying to be an actress. And I used to put the CDs on in the car to practice, like, to get... as I would drive over here, and sometimes I'd get the therapy and the voice coach at the same time. So as I was driving here thinking, there were just so many associations going on.
Sure, sure. You thought you were going to go talk about your deepest feelings and fake an American accent while doing it.
Yeah, which is impossible, which is why that never worked out. But all that is to say, thank you for having me in your home. Kind of get it out there now that we have an animal called Rabbit in the room.
Yes, yes. But he's not a rabbit. He is a dog. He's a little misleading. He's a dog named Rabbit, but he likes to hang out in my office, so he's here with us as well.
Well, I'm wondering, because we're sitting in your office, and you have a beautiful home, but this office is quite calm and zen with some kind of beautifully structured books on the wall. I'm wondering... because we are here to talk about your latest book,
yeah.
Daisy Jones and the Six, is this where that book was written?
This is where that book was edited.
Oh.
And this office, pretty much as you see it, was just in another home 5 minutes away. But when my daughter was born 2.5 years ago, my husband and I had bought a house. And then by the time she got to be about a year and a half, we're like, I think we need a little bit more space. And so we moved here. And that was right after I sold Daisy Jones, but I hadn't yet dug into my editor's edits on it. And so a lot of the editing of it and the fine tuning of the lyrics and stuff was all here.
So we have to talk about this book. When I was lucky enough, you know, to get the galley version of it, I just started reading. And often I'll just pick up a book, start reading, and I'll know pretty soon whether it's something that interests me or, you know, is kind of going to be the right fit for the podcast. So this book reads like a transcript of this band.
Right.
And delving into the history of this incredibly iconic band and how it rose to fame and then how it split up very dramatically. Mm-hmm. Now, I am that person who then went to Google Daisy Jones.
She's not real. No. I know. I wish she was real.
So what was the impulse behind making up particularly this woman and then her, let's say, nemesis and love, Billy?
Yeah.
Can you talk about this type of relationship and maybe where it was inspired from in history of music?
Yeah. Well, I have always been really drawn to the drama behind music, even if it's something as sort of silly on the outside as reading like all of Ariana Grande's lyrics and then being like, well, this one's about Pete Davidson and this one's about, you know, I'm always curious what artists are putting in their work. I remember in the 90s, like reading No Doubt lyrics and being like, is this about Gavin Rossdale? Or, you know, like I just love doing that. So that was the germ of it, was my love for listening to music and trying to understand where the lyrics come from. And some of these romantic musical duos that I've been long fascinated by. The most obvious one being Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham. But there were many, many others that I was drawing from. The Civil Wars are really interesting to me as a band that they were not romantically involved, but they had this very creative output. And yet clearly something went wrong between the two of them because they broke up very abruptly one night. Or you have people like Emmylou Harris and Graham Parsons, you know, were they together? Were they not together? You know, now I think Emmylou Harris says, you know, we were, but at the time it was unclear. Joni Mitchell and Graham Nash, you know, or even as silly as it is, like when you look at like Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, like they're not together, but boy, does it feel like they are when they perform together. So I wanted to create people like that. I wanted to create my version of, are they together? Are they not together? You know, like, why does it look so good when they're together if they're not really together? And that's how I came up with Daisy and Billy. And that's the beginning of this really complicated, messy love story between two people who are just fire when it comes to their talent, that they combust in this incredible way and create great music. But they also sort of make each other combust personally too.
Well, there's a great quote that I think you said when you were talking about your previous book, The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, and it was, my passion is capturing what it feels like to be in love, be it romantic or otherwise. And it was interesting to read that and then think about this book because it does feel like this is about so many different types of love.
Yeah.
And one of the loves I found really compelling is between Billy and his wife, Camilla.
Yeah.
So for everyone listening, you can imagine if Taylor's just been talking about this combustible
yeah.
chemistry between Daisy and Billy, and now we learn, oh, he had a wife?
Yeah, it can't be. Yeah. So part of what was really interesting to me about taking these characters of Daisy and Billy, who are so passionate and have this fiery sort of connection, for better or worse, what's interesting about that is what is in contrast to that. Because There are a lot of love stories that are epic and larger than life, and they feel, you know, doomed from the outset in this very romantic way. But that's not real life love. You know, those are stories that we tell and we're captivated by them, but real life love is every day. You know, it's very boring. It's very mundane. It's choosing to stay every single day, despite how difficult it may be, despite how easy it may be to say, I'd like to check out now, please. And so I wanted to have multiple types of love in this story. And Billy and Camila meet very, very early on in Billy's career. He's basically just the lead singer of a wedding band when they meet. They're both very young and they have an incredible connection and they build a life together. And they have built that life together and they're holding on and they have a kid. And Billy is trying to stay sober when he meets Daisy. So it's pretty much like the worst time possible for him to meet someone that really ignites him in that way. And he's pulled between these two sides of himself. I don't want to reduce it to say that he's pulled between these two women, because they're never really in opposition to each other, and nor do they feel that way. It's not really a love triangle. It's not anything.
No, it's not competitive.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like, ooh, who will he choose? I don't think. It's more about the process of, two different women that ignite different parts of himself, and how he moves through his days weathering that, and how sustainable that is. You know, it's only sustainable for a certain period of time, and then something has to happen. And that question is, what happens?
I know, which we cannot talk about now. But when we're introduced to Daisy, I was wanting to highlight and asterisk and kind of dig into these lines she has. And one of them I'm just going to find, which I thought that really connected with me, was, I am not a muse. I am the somebody. And I think for so many girls and women, I don't know about you, but I feel like I started this whole, you know, acting into writing thing. And I used to be drawn to men who were doing the thing I had wanted to do.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
And I didn't even realize at the time.
Yeah.
And then there's this switch where you're like, oh, I think I'm smarter than that guy. I just right. wanted, it's been yeah. interesting talking to him about
yeah.
his process, but actually I want to do this thing.
Yeah.
And I feel like Daisy learns that lesson really quickly. And there's one great moment, which I'd love you to tell us about, which I think, I hope everyone doesn't go and recreate this, but I should have brought some champagne for us because we're both yeah. drinking coffee.
Yeah, that's true.
But can you tell us what the up and down is and yes. if you made that up?
Yes. I'm so glad that you're asking about that, because there's even more to the story of an up and down than is on the page. And that is first of all, what's an up and down? So I made it up. I don't think it's real.
Oh, awesome.
but essentially, Daisy Jones, by the time, I mean, really early in the book, we've established that she's got a drug problem. And it's, I mean, problem is a strong word only in that it's the 70s and a lot of people have a drug problem. So it's a little, she doesn't necessarily think it's a problem. She's not thinking of it that way. But she's taking a lot of diet pills. She's taking, she's drinking a lot. She's an insomniac, so she's got trouble sleeping. So every morning when she goes someplace, she will order what she calls an up and down, which is the champagne to keep the coffee to keep her up and champagne to keep her down. And she's drinking both of those things to sort of level herself out. And she is at a restaurant with a guy that she's dating who is a, you know, writer director character. And she orders an up and down. And he goes, oh, that's so good. I got to write that down. I got to put that in something. And that's when Daisy starts talking about the difference between, you know, being a muse and being the somebody, because she gets really mad. And she says, you know, I was so frustrated by the idea that I'm just supposed to be here to inspire some man's great idea. You know, like, I am not somebody's muse. I am the somebody. That was a scene that came to me really early on. It's early in the book, but it was also early in the drafts. And it was something that was very important to me to say. It was important for Daisy to say, but it was also for me, Taylor Jenkins Reid, to put in something, because I once went on a date with a guy who I wasn't really that into, but he was very nice and he had really pursued me. And I thought, you know, give the guy a chance. And so we're at Barney's Beanery, which is a bar in Los Angeles. It's like, you know, it's like of all the bars in LA to be at, Barney's Beanery is kind of like a sports bar. It's like not the most LA thing. It does. It has a huge history, and it's also got an incredible like rock history in particular, because it's right in the middle of West Hollywood. But West Hollywood is such a vibrant sort of queer space where anything goes, and Barney's Beanery is like the most like down the line sports bar you can have. So it's just a funny space. But I was at Barney's Beanery with this guy, and we're on this date, and I don't like the taste of alcohol. And so I had ordered a Washington Apple, which is a fairly mild cocktail, and a Diet Coke because I didn't like the taste.
So that was your chaser.
That was my chaser. And I had said to him, making fun of myself, I was like, well, here's my cocktail and here's my chaser. And he thought that was the funniest thing, that because I didn't drink, I needed a chaser for a cocktail. So he says, that is so funny. And he takes out a pad from his back pocket, this guy who fancies himself a writer, and he writes it down. He goes, I'm going to use that someday. And I was boiling with rage for two reasons. One, let's say I didn't know what I was saying and I didn't know how funny it was. It's still not for you to take. I'm not here for your amusement. I'm not here to inspire you by accident or not. So that was already frustrating. But I knew what I was saying. I knew it was funny. I knew it was absurd. For me to make a joke and then for you to think you can explain my joke to me as if I don't get my own joke and then you're going to go use it later on, I could not believe that he would do that. And so when I was imagining this idea that Daisy Jones is with somebody and they're taking something from her, I was like, I want to put that in there. But of course, it couldn't be that Daisy Jones can't handle her alcohol. That would be crazy. Daisy Jones does not need a chaser for a very mild cocktail. Only I do. So I had to come up with something else, something that was the Daisy Jones version of that, that she was aware of, that she knew why it was clever. And this guy was trying to explain her to her.
I feel like that is the crux of the book.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
Because it felt like as a woman,
yes,
that was the lesson for me out of this. And it was so important that I just loved that.
Thank you. It was the most important piece for me in writing it because, you know, it's something I still struggle with, to be honest. I think we just teach women, sometimes on purpose, sometimes by accident, to be quiet. You know, and that if they do speak up and they're not immediately agreed with, that they should back down. I'm still doing it every day, you know, but I really wanted to create a character that wasn't going to do that, that just wasn't going to accept the premise. No, I have something to say. I'm here. I'm important. You're not going to take from me. This is mine. You know, there was a large part of my life where I would have thought being the inspiration for a man's idea was hugely flattering. It's only now that I'm married to a man who would never reduce me that way, who encourages me to speak for myself, who, you know, that I'm 35 now, I have a daughter, I've, you know, come into myself in certain ways that now I feel like, okay, yeah, no, I'm not here for you. I'm here for me. And my ideas are mine and they're for me to say. And I would like people to listen to me say them. I don't want you to take them and use them for yourself. But, you know, a muse is something that we've really romanticized and we've made it something that for a long time was the highest aspiration a woman could be, to be a great man's muse. And so once I saw in my head that Daisy would just immediately reject that idea, she made a lot more sense to me. I was like, okay, like I was early on in the process. I was like, okay, if she's going to make this stand and this is what she's going to say, I understand the trajectory she's going on. I understand who she is.
It just is so interesting because that idea too, that isn't it often the people that we don't even like
Oh,
that
sure.
we give a chance and they take something from us. Like, I'm just thinking of you going on a date.
Yeah.
So often it's the thing, like, I'm going to go again because I my instincts are telling me
I'm not into it.
And yet you go and they're the ones that take
Well,
from
I think
you.
That's, I think that was what was so infuriating about it was because, you know, I'm here to give you a chance. You know, you've pursued me to the point where you've made it very, very clear how serious you are. I'm not sure that I'm into it, but you've pushed it to the point where I'm going to give you a shot. And with that shot, you're going to take something from me that you don't even think is taking. You think you're flattering me by saying you want to take it from me. You know, thank God I got mad. Because I think it just as easily I could have fallen for it and said, oh, he thinks I'm so charming, you know? I'm proud of myself that it clicked in my brain of going, oh no, that's totally
crap off.
Like, you know, because again, like I've fallen for that narrative so many times that, you know, we're all here to support the important men with their important work. You know, that's why I need someone like Daisy. For me, I need someone like her in the world because I need someone to look up to. I need someone to say the things that I'm daring to think in my head, you know? And that's what Daisy is. And that's what Evelyn Hugo, who I wrote, you know, before this was for me too. I'm nowhere near as strong and outspoken as Daisy. And I'm not nearly as driven in a particular way as Evelyn Hugo, but I write them because I want someone to look up to. I want them to exist so that we can all be a little bit more like them.
I definitely felt like I needed a Daisy too, or I imagined an Angela that was more Daisy. And mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, I can channel her more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's honestly my dream. It really is. Like, you know, Daisy's deeply imperfect, as is Evelyn Hugo. I'm not saying everyone should go out and behave exactly like them all the time. There's a lot of problems with that. But there are elements to them that I want a little bit more of in my soul. I want to feel a little bit more daring in the ways that they're daring. And somewhat radical in their approach to things. You know, Daisy, in addition to the fact that she really insists on being heard on her own terms, she also refuses to dress a particular way to please anyone. And, you know, on the outside, that may seem fairly simple, like, oh, she's got her own style, whatever. But what we're actually talking about is if Daisy shows up in a tank top and no bra, and men are talking about her, and women are saying that she's undermining herself by doing that, Daisy Jones is saying, I'm not here to please you. I'm hot, and I don't want to wear a bra. And that's completely fine. She's not taking on other people's reactions to her body. And that's something I'm really proud of too for her, because I'm not there, you know, like I'm very aware when I'm getting dressed of what will someone think of this, or am I presenting a certain way, or is this to this or whatever. You know, Daisy Jones is saying, I will dress how I want to dress and you are expected to respect me regardless of what I have on, because you should be respecting me based on who I am, not the fact that it's hot outside and I would like to not be wearing a jacket.
And isn't it amazing how when we get there ourselves, or because she respects herself and just walks her life that way, when we do that, somehow it has this effect. You know, it's the classic thing of when people walk into a room. It's like when we meet someone for the first time, or a certain person has they're okay in their own skin.
It's so powerful. And I think it's something I think of on a daily basis, because I'm always trying to get closer to feeling comfortable in my own skin and just saying, you know, this is who I am. You can take me or leave me. It's what I'm aiming toward. I'm far from it, but it's always where I'm trying to go. And I look at, you know, someone like Cardi B, for instance, who, you know, Cardi B is so uniquely herself. No one could be her. And she can't be anyone but who she is. And she does so many things that people would say don't do. She shares a lot of stuff on social media. She, you know, she swears like every other word. You know, she says things she shouldn't say, you know, whatever. Should. And yet it's magic. I honestly think that woman is just magic. Like, she is so entertaining. She is so charming and compelling. And I can't take my eyes off of her because she is 100% herself. She's in her own body, being whatever her soul was meant to be. And it is electrifying. And I think about every time I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have said that word, or I didn't explain myself properly, and what if they don't understand, or I shouldn't admit that I felt this way, or I shouldn't have worn that shirt. And it's like, Cardi B is not doing that. You know what I mean? Cardi B is not,
she is
leaving a party
on.
yeah she's not going, do you think someone was offended? You know, she's like, this is me, take it or leave it. And I'm taking it, man. Like, I find her just enchanting. And there are so many examples of that. I think, you know, even like Spike Lee, who at the Oscars, you know, he's wearing a purple suit and gold sneakers. You know, everyone else is dressed to the nines and, you know, tuxes. He's got these wacky purple glasses on. And it's just like, yeah, he's just being Spike Lee. And the rules don't apply to him. And they shouldn't, you know?
And all these rules.
I know. There are so many rules.
Oh my God.
I know. I just feel like I'm such a rule follower. And I'm always like, oh, was I not supposed
Me
to?
Me too.
Oh,
I'm trying
God.
To break
oh,
it though.
No. Like, it's so, you know, I think in general, we're humans don't like to break a rule. But women, it's even harder because the stakes are much harder for us. I want to channel that feeling of, you know, they'll like it or they won't, but this is who I am. I'm really, you know, it's a process. But I was saying to my husband the other day, you know, I have a tour coming up and I have a lot of different events and outfits that I have to plan. And, you know, and I'm like, oh, well, should I not wear this? And I don't know. And is this what I want to put forth or whatever? And I just had the thought of like, you know what? What if I just like Adam Sandler'd it? And I was just like, this is me in my sweatpants. Every single place I go, you will know that I will show up in sweatpants. And eventually people will just say, oh, that, you know what? That's just how she is. She just yes. shows up in her sweatpants. Like, oh, you know what? Taylor Jenkins Reid doesn't wear pants. She only wears leggings. Hasn't worn pants in, you know, 20 years. And people will get on board if you just like
commit.
Yeah, exactly. But I gotta choose to commit. You know, I tell you what, like if a year from now you haven't seen me in a real outfit, we'll say I succeeded.
That's great. I don't know about your experience, but I feel with mine, the relationships and friendships I've had with women.
Yeah.
Are almost in a way a model for how you could try and have a romantic relationship, only in the way that there's such an openness and an honesty with some relationships that you almost, you practice in that way
yeah.
first. And for Daisy, maybe, you know, you could talk a little bit about how, because of her upbringing, for her even finding that relationship was difficult and such a blessing.
Yeah. So Daisy is born into a family that's like pretty glamorous. Like her father's a famous painter and her mother's a French model, and they live in the Hollywood Hills behind the Sunset Strip. And they've got a lot of money, but they just don't care about their kid at all. You know, they're always busy doing parties. I sound like I go to a lot of parties, don't I? They're always
you
busy
do.
Doing parties. Yeah. They're always busy
you don't go
having
to parties.
Parties. You do them. Parties. they have a lot of parties and they're just not paying attention to their kid. And so she really does grow up with that sense that she doesn't matter. She doesn't matter to anybody. And she starts going out clubbing to the places on the Sunset Strip, which is very easy for her because she lives right there. So she's walking to all these places. She's very young, about 14. And at one of the places, she meets this woman, Simone, who is a black disco singer who is just coming up. And Daisy and Simone become best friends. And Simone really becomes Daisy's family. And there were a lot of reasons why I wanted to include Simone in the story. But the biggest one for me is that in my life, the most transformative relationships that I've had have been my female friends. And, you know, it's funny, you know, in Wuthering Heights, when the quote is like, you know, whatever souls are made of, his and mine are the same. I always think about that quote when I think about my girlfriends. I have a lot of friends from high school that I'm still very close with, and they make me feel okay. Just sort of existing in the world. I'm never alone. You know, I could be in a fight with my husband and my daughter could be driving me nuts and, you know, and the dog's barking or whatever. And it's like, well, I have my friends, which sounds really hollow, but like I have these, three friends from high school and we're all in this one text chain that we've called, I don't know why, but it's called the Peanuts. I think it was a joke, but then it just lasted too long. And so now like we're always texting each other all day, every day. And it's like, you know, my husband would be like, are you talking to the Peanuts? You know, it's like, well, you know, and it's like, well, what do the Peanuts say? You know, it's like, I always know that I have the Peanuts. Or my friend Aaron from high school too. It's like, you know, I have people who accept me in a really like radical way. Of it doesn't matter what I do or say, there's love there for me. That's wildly, wildly powerful. And yeah, I'm really fortunate. Like I've been married for 10 years. My romantic relationship is very important to me and I'm very proud of it and I nurture it every day. My friendships with my friends have made my life easier and made it livable. And so Simone is that for Daisy. And there's a part in the book where Daisy's feeling really alone and she's talking to Simone on the phone and Simone is on tour. She's on a tour of Europe and Daisy's just saying, you know, I feel like I have nobody. And Simone says, you know, imagine that you're a blinking light and I'm a blinking light. And when you look at a map of the world, there are two blinking lights. So no matter where we are, we're both blinking together, you know, in sync. And to me, that is, you know, that's my friend Julia, that's my friend Emily, my friend Ashley, my friend Aaron, you know, my friend Sarah and Tamara. No matter where I am, we're all blinking, right? I'm always going to be there for them and happy to be there for them. That's a love that there's truly nothing like it. And I like to include that in as many of my books as I can because I think it's just as important. But this one, it was really, really important because Daisy needs to have a home and she doesn't have one at her home and she has it with Simone.
Well, and to that point too, because she does have a drug problem that gets really serious.
Yeah.
Which, you know, Stevie Nicks, we know about her addictions too. And without that friendship, actually you get a sense that Daisy wouldn't be alive.
Yeah. I mean, everyone has to have somebody that's there holding the safety net. And I think that's what's really tough with someone like Daisy is there just weren't that many people to hold the safety net. You know, I've had periods of time in my life where I felt like maybe I don't have enough people holding the safety net. But there always is somebody. And Simone is doing that for Daisy. Daisy hits rock bottom a number of times and doesn't better herself. And Simone is always there.
Yeah, she doesn't abandon her.
No.
Right?
She doesn't abandon her. And yet
it'd be really difficult when you have a friend that has a drug or alcohol problem like that. Sometimes you have to go, I don't know how to be there mm-hmm. again.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Simone doesn't abandon her. And Simone also understands and has the ability to understand that there is a boundary, that she can't fix Daisy, and that all she can do is, you know, bear witness to what is happening and be there when Daisy's ready to change, you know, which is a really very special type of friendship that's not an easy thing to do.
for that research of how the drugs worked then.
Yeah.
Like that, yeah. You know, the uppers and the downers. And we right. know that, well, in the book, you talk a lot about how people would say that it's the downers that kill you.
Right.
And I found this quote. I actually interviewed an Aussie journalist who'd had an interview with Aaron Sorkin. Mm-hmm. That's his name, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I know his yeah. name.
Aaron Sorkin, you're good.
But he had this quote that said, because I actually hadn't realized about mm-hmm. his addiction.
Oh, yeah. Aaron Sorkin had a coke problem?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he wrote A Few Good Men high.
Oh, really? Okay.
And they had to then make a decision not
to continue
and was incredibly worried about whether he would be able to write yeah. when he wasn't.
That's really hard, especially when you're being rewarded for your addiction, which yeah. a lot of times artists are.
Well, and this quote he said was, the real problem with drugs is that they work right up until the moment they kill you. And I wanted in the research for this, because the language, I mean, you write from the perspective of all these different band members, and that ease and knowledge of which they talk about drugs, right?
Yeah.
The benzos, this and that. It's so authentic.
Oh, thank you. It's really, yeah, and it's so a lot of pretending on my part.
I think that's why, you know, you yeah. read it and you're like, whoa, that must have been what it was like.
Yeah.
It's so constant. I guess, how did you work on that? And those yeah. voices and making them so authentic.
Especially given that I can't handle a cocktail. yeah, it was kind of funny because I am such a teetotaler. Like I'm such a, I'm pretty boring in that regard. And so I started by reading a lot of rock interviews and biographies and taking note of, you know, how far the drugs went, what the drugs were, you know, even something as sort of silly as like, you know, they're all backstage and they're all drinking. Well, what are they drinking, right? Like someone like Billy is going to be drinking something different or have a taste for something different than someone like Warren. And I did have a moment where I was like, well, what does Daisy drink? You know, because
champagne and
yeah,
brandy.
That's right.
Champagne, that's it. Yeah. I was thinking, I'm going to try that.
I know.
Combo. I know.
Yeah. She, so alcohol is something that is, when people are into it, they have a very specific interest in it. Most people aren't like, oh, just give me anything. People are like, you know, Hendrix with a twist or, you know, whatever. I don't even know what that is. I think it's gin. So what I did was I looked at a number of different rock stars and what were the drugs that they were doing? What was the way that they were doing them? And how would that fit in here? And there were a couple of different things that I wanted to be paying attention to. One is that something feeling real versus being true are two different things. So if I wrote in this story that the Six was getting up to the same stuff that the Rolling Stones were getting up to in the 60s and 70s, it would have been a very disturbing story. The truth is that Keith Richards was doing a lot of heroin, you know, shooting it up. You know, it's going to feel really over the top in this book. So how do I take what the truth is and find what feels real? Truth is stranger than fiction, I guess, is what I'm getting at. You know, the wild stories of rock bands in the 60s and 70s are stuff that if I wrote it as fiction, you'd be like, this is ridiculous. No person can do this many drugs. And I'd be like, well, yes, they can technically, you know. So there was that of wanting it to feel real. And then the other piece is that, you know, drug addiction is alcohol addiction. This is real painful stuff. And this is stuff that people are facing every single day. It's people that I love have faced. It's not to be taken lightly. It's not to be played for plot. So I wanted to make sure that if these people are alcoholics or drug addicts, that, you know, it's honest and it's earnest. There's a lot of pain here. And so I basically did two things. I took the feeling of wanting something from my own life, and then I changed what those wanting, what the characters wanted to things that were much more rock and roll than my life. So like there's a period of time where Billy is talking about his behavior on the road and the things that he's gotten up to that he shouldn't be up to, which are things I've never done in my life. But he talks about there's the point where you have a black line and then you cross it. And now, even though you tell yourself you're never going to do it again, you've given yourself the very dangerous information that you could cross that line and it wouldn't be the end of the world. So suddenly you start crossing that line more and more and more, and it just fades and it gets grayer and grayer until one day you're looking back and you're saying, I think there was a line here once. And
also if there are only consequences if people find out things,
yeah,
right? And then
yeah.
I definitely, that was a really powerful moment in the book, which we'll let people kind of discover a bit for themselves. But when you get away with something.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
It's dangerous. Mm-hmm. Oh, and just, I don't know if you, I remember I kissed someone. I mean, when I mm-hmm. was so young.
Yeah.
You know, when I had a boyfriend and like, when you do that the first time, I really don't do that mm-hmm. because that feeling was so revolting mm-hmm. and that it was, I can't even describe it anymore. It was like shame yeah. and disgust. And I thought, I can't live with this
right.
sense of mm-hmm. myself. So I'm never going to do this again.
Right. And see, it's interesting that you could self-correct because a lot of people can't. And they'd say, yeah, I felt disgust or yeah, I felt ashamed of myself, but I got away with it. There were no other consequences, so I'm going to do it again. And I think also, you know, we have a lot of people that like to feel ashamed. That's part of the human psyche, you know, is like,
yeah.
oh yeah, I did something and I shouldn't have done it and I feel bad about it, but I'm used to feeling bad. And, you know, feeling bad is feeling something. And I think that's a big part of Billy's psychology, you know, is not feeling like he's worth much and so making decisions that he knows are self-sabotaging. I'm a little bit more similar to you. I'm not a big self-sabotager, but then I will in like these very concentrated ways where I'm literally watching myself do exactly what I just said I wouldn't do. And the thing for me, as banal as it sounds, is sugar. Like my addiction to sugar is just like off the charts. Like I will literally say to my husband, like, you know what? I'm only gonna have one cupcake today. That cupcake I just had, that's the last one for today. And then 2 hours later, I'm eating half a pan of brownies and I'm going, I shouldn't be eating these brownies, but I can't stop eating these brownies. And you know, that is such a mundane sort of addiction, but that's where that psychology makes sense to me. I can tap into the psychology of, someone that does exactly what they shouldn't be doing. You know, it's just in rock and roll, it's not sugar, it's heroin, you know? But the idea is the same. Can you stop yourself from doing the thing that you want to do that you shouldn't do? And I mean, that's the story of so much of our lives. And that's Billy's story in particular. He is a man constantly wanting to do one thing and knows that he should do the other thing. And he's always conflicted about what those two things are. And I do think, I think it's compelling, right, to watch anyone be stuck between two places and seeing what side of their soul went out. That's always going to be interesting. But I also think in terms of who he is as a rock star, I think that's really kind of cool. Like here's this bad boy and he's good looking and he can sing and he's talented and he's just going, I am the sort of person that would naturally sleep with all these women and then do all these drugs, but I'm not going to. I'm going to hold it together as hard as it may be and go home to my wife. You know, I mean, that's love. There's a sexiness there of that type of masculinity of saying, you know, no, the power here is in controlling myself.
Well, and it's, yeah, being able to control your impulses.
Right.
And really, I mean, that's what so much of life is,
yeah,
isn't it? Like I'm making a choice. Yeah. And when you're sober, you're able to you can walk away
mm-hmm.
far more easily than when
yeah.
we're not.
Exactly.
Another really interesting part of the book is the role that Rolling Stone has
yeah.
in, shaping these narratives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, can you talk about some of these journalists, or was there a certain story that inspired the type of story that went on in the book? You know, when like a journalist would travel with the band,
yeah,
and they would write these pieces that were, and they were so intimate,
yeah,
and yet they had the power to, yeah, shape the narrative for the world.
Yeah. So I think it's really fascinating, this relationship between rock and rock journalism. Certainly we know existed in the 70s between rock and rock journalists. The most obvious entry point we have into that is the movie Almost Famous, right? Like Cameron Crowe, as a teenager, he's on the road with this band. I mean, the movie's fiction and Cameron Crowe's real life is obviously his real life. So I shouldn't conflate the two, but this idea that you're trying to get access and you're trying to get a good story, but you're also observing these sort of day-to-day sort of things about a band and pulling it all together to tell the story. But what I think is the most interesting about that process is less the time you spend with the band and more how, certainly at the time when, you know, now we have 1,000 different news outlets and different ways for fans to talk directly to an audience. But back then, really, like, there's a couple channels. And Rolling Stone was one of the biggest ways for a listener to understand the band that they like, right? So that's an incredible amount of power that that journalist has. You're setting the image and the tone and the whole vibe for this band. You're the lens through which we see this thing. And that's what's really fascinating to me about rock journalism, especially someone like Jonah Berg, who is the fictional rock journalist in Daisy Jones and the Six. He is invited to spend time with the band on a number of different occasions. And the articles that he writes about the band have a very real impact on how, not only how the band is seen and their success, but also how they see themselves. You know, he's a mirror reflecting his own lens, right? Like, it's not a total, you know, everyone brings their own opinion to it. So it's not really spoiling anything to say that the first time that Jonah Berg meets with the Six, when then it's Daisy Jones and the Six are two different acts, but they're performing on the same bill. And what he writes is an article called The Six That Should Be Seven. And Jonah Berg is the first person to say, Daisy Jones should be in this band. It's crazy that Daisy Jones is not a full-fledged member of the Six. And everyone in the band has their own reactions to that. That has a very, like, it's a very strong reaction. Daisy is very excited by it. She's like a kid at Christmas, you know, like, what are they all going to say? I love this idea. You know, and Billy is like very put off by it. And the other members of the band are all at different places with it. But Jonah Berg, as an outsider writing about this band, is in a unique position to say, oh, whatever it is you think you're doing, here's what it looks like. Here's what it looks like to the rest of us. And I'm just fascinated by that, because that's the beginning of when we talk about star image. Like, this band is one thing in the inner circle, but who are they on the larger stage of 70s rock? The reader of this book needs to know that just as much as they need to know, you know, you got to know what it looks like in order to know how that's different than what it felt like for them. Jonah Berg is how you figure out, what did it look like? And it looked like this crazy, talented, massive band with this electric chemistry.
Yeah, he definitely helps. It puts the band in context into how they were seen around the world.
Yeah.
And then we can liken it to bands we know. You're like, oh, they were Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah. But,
you know, yeah, in their reach.
Right, exactly.
She was Janis Joplin in, yes, her,
yeah,
like, electricity, yeah, on stage.
Yeah, or Linda Ronstadt, or, you know, I mean, it's funny. She's a lot of different people at once. And I think that's why someone like Jonah Berg in the book is as helpful to me as the writer as he is because it's a really easy way for me to tell you, like, in the world of Fleetwood Mac, the Eagles, Linda Ronstadt, Jackson Browne, Steve Miller Band, you know, here's where you should imagine they fit in.
And now you've had many of your books kind of developed into things, yeah. And you've written scripts for things, but Daisy and the Six is going to be,
yes,
an Amazon series produced by Reese Witherspoon, which,
yes,
gets, I'm sure, pretty crazy. What was
pretty
that
thrilling.
Process like,
yeah,
in terms of, because the book, we're recording this and the book hasn't even come out yet.
Right, right. We're still a week and a half out or a week out. So it was really crazy. It was really crazy because as someone that works in both film and books, I have long been enamored with what she's able to do in terms of getting projects off the ground. It's really incredible. She does it fast, she does it well, and she does it with the right intention. She is telling stories about women and women's inner lives, and she's doing it unapologetically and very powerfully. So, you know, take away the fact that she's like this very glamorous movie star. Who wouldn't want to work with someone who has that kind of track record and that has that much passion? So we submitted it to Hello Sunshine. And, you know, sure, yeah, submit anything, right? Like, why not try? It's like buying a lottery ticket. Like, oh, sure, I'll pick up a lottery ticket. Nothing's going to happen. Maybe I'll even, you know, remember to check it next week, see if I won. But like, that's obviously, you don't think, I wasn't sitting there like, oh, fingers crossed. You know, you just, you submit your work and you hope that somebody takes liking to it. But when you're submitting it to Reese Witherspoon, you understand that you're up against, you know, a bunch of incredible projects because everyone wants to work with her. So when I got an email from my manager and like very late at night one night that was like, Reese read it in a day, they want to talk to you. It was like, oh my God. Like I was, I mean, just white as a ghost. Like I was just like, like my eyes wide open, my, you know, jaw to the floor. It was just really, really cool. I think that will probably be one of those things I remember forever because it just came out of nowhere. It wasn't like, oh, you know what? Reese is reading it, or like, oh, they're actually going to take, you know, maybe, which is how you get most yeses in your life is it's like, you know, it starts at a, perhaps, and it grows to like, this might happen. You know, this was just one day there was no shot, and the next day she wanted it, which is incredible. And Scott Neustadter and Michael Weber are attached to write it. They are some of the best screenwriters in town. I have long been a fan of their stuff. 500 Days of Summer was their first movie, and I just loved that movie so much when it came out. So it really feels a little bit like a dream team. Like I'm pinching myself. I'm like first in line to want to watch it. I'm like, yeah, I know I wrote it, but like I'm so excited to see what you guys do with it. I just can't wait to watch it.
Well, because we'll have to wrap up soon. So I have this new thing on Lit Up, and my dream is that at the end of each season, people will, you know, we'll be able to see which has been the most popular episode, and like the six most popular ones. I want to make a candle that's the scent.
Oh my
of the
God.
Author.
Oh my. Well, I'm have a candle problem.
Okay, so let's make it about Daisy and the Six.
Yes.
And Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Okay.
So if there was like a crossover of,
yes,
what you would like to be like, do you want it to be like dirt or,
yeah,
what, pine? You can have just like a whole slew of,
yes,
words, whatever, colors, somethings.
So it's got to be in conflict, right? It's got to be two different smells that are kind of working together, and they come together to be more than the sum of their parts. I'm going strong floral on one side, like a lilac. I love a honeysuckle. I even love rose, even though it sometimes has like an old lady smell to it. But I love all those. Gardenia. Oh, gardenia. I love gardenia. So that's on the one side. And then I think like, oh, maybe we could do like a sandalwood or a tobacco or like a kind of like manly like undernote maybe. So it's like, what I'm designing, a perfume person could be listening and going, that would smell like garbage.
No, this is, but we can have someone interpret this.
Okay, great. I want it to be in conflict with each other. I want like the floral feminine, and I want the like smoky, you know, kind of like tobacco dude smell too.
Oh, I'm just imagining it's kind of the after the show,
yeah,
like when someone sweat,
yes,
and they've sang, and it's like a bit of Billy's sweat and a bit
like
of Daisy's,
musk.
Yes. And they're like trying to stay away from each other because they can the scent of each other after connecting so much,
I love it.
And then having to stay away,
yes. Please, yes.
Okay, well, I think we may know what's going
to
be.
That was the easiest question for you to answer.
That was the best. Well, thank you so, so much.
Oh, thank you.
And good luck with the book and everything else.
Thank you.
It's going to be fun to watch the ride.
Oh, thank you. It's so, so exciting to, I was going to say to be here. It's always exciting to be in my home, but it's just really exciting to be able to talk to you. It's such a great podcast. I'm very flattered to be included.
Thank you so much. I took so much away from this conversation, but I think the main thing was that as a woman, I don't want to be someone's muse. I want to be the one creating the work. And so we touched on that in so many ways, but really honing in on that and going, don't be the inspiration for someone's work, be the one creating the work is what I took away. Let me know what you think. I'd love to hear. Get in touch at Lit Up Show on Instagram and Twitter.